around the kitchen table, somebody would say something and I would just go, okay, wait. There's a bizarro in there. Let's keep working on this. How do we massage this into a bizarro?
In case you're not familiar with bizarro cartoons, they're eccentric, surreal, and yes, bizarre looks into everyday life. And they are hilarious, filled with wry humor and puns and very clever wordplay. I'm Elizabeth Pearson Garr, and my guest today, Cliff Harris, is one of the brilliant minds behind those ideas. He's one of a small team that contributes ideas to Dan Peraro, the creator of Bizarro. As you'll hear, Cliff began his career as a pediatrician, and he's now a consultant for medical philanthropy and fundraising. Heads up, Cliff and I talk about some of his cartoons in the interview. You can see those cartoons by going to the show notes on our website. Go to whatitslike2.net and click on Cliff's box. But no worries if you don't. Even though this episode is called What It's Like to Write Bizarro Cartoons, it's about a lot more than just cartoons. Thank you for being here, Dr. Cliff Harris. I appreciate that. May I call you Cliff?
Please.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think you have a really fascinating career history because you started as a physician and now you work in many areas, but among other things, you write for cartoons and
That's right.
You consult in medical philanthropy. So I'm curious about your whole trajectory. You must have had this curious mind, this creative mind always. What age were you when you realized that you had this penchant for writing?
So when I was in third grade, I came home from school one day, frustrated because I had been assigned a task that I thought was going to be impossible. Because the task was to interview someone who is in the job that we want to do when we grow up.
Oh.
And at that point, I knew that I wanted to be a cartoonist. And I thought, well, I don't know how to reach any professional cartoonists. I'm not going to be able to do this assignment. And I was always super concerned about doing the assignment right and getting a good grade, which is probably part of the story of how one ends up in medical school. But that, so my mother said, well, why don't you interview Charles M. Schulz?
Of Peanuts.
And I had all the Peanuts books, you know, and everything.
Of course.
This is 1971. So, you know, Peanuts is everything. They had just painted Snoopy on the side of the Apollo module. It was everywhere. So I said, well, how can I speak with Charles Schulz? She said, well, I think he lives in Santa Rosa or something. And this is back in the rotary phone days. So she picks up the phone and dials 411. You remember?
Information.
And I hear her say, hello, yes, for Santa Rosa. Do you have a number for Charles M. Schulz? And then she says, oh, yes. And she's writing it down. And then she hangs up and then she dials. You know. And then she says, hello, is this Charles M. Schulz? Yes, well, my son would like to speak with you. And then she hands me the bag.
I love everything about this. I love your mom. I love that his number was listed. I love that he answered the phone.
Right? All those things. So I have my list of questions. And what actually happened in the conversation at this point, whatever we're talking, 50 years later, it's somewhat a blur. But what I remember is that he was in no hurry. Mm-hmm. He was happy to answer all my questions. He told me about how he starts in pencil lightly, and then he uses this very special pen that they didn't make anymore. And so he bought out the company so he could make sure he'd always have those special nibs. And it was a real pen that he'd dip in an inkwell, and that he tended to do the Monday through Saturday all in one go. And then he would do the Sunday separately. Oh. And how he got started, and he went to this art school, and it was just, I remember that. And I don't remember what my teacher thought or if she even believed me when I turned in my report. So that was that. I had this fantastic experience that obviously stayed with me my whole life. And then by the time I got to high school, there was a pediatrician in town who was my hero, and he let me tag along with him and attend some deliveries and go to his office. So by 16, I knew I wanted to be a pediatrician. And the cartooning thing was always just, I would just doodle on pieces of paper and I would draw pictures of the kids when I did become a pediatrician, but it was just a fun thing.
And everyone would say, oh, you're such a good artist. Would people give you a lot of kudos for that?
Yeah, to be honest, I'm not a great artist. I'm good enough. And I took a couple of cartooning classes, but I think it was very clear to me that that was not a way I'd ever be able to feed myself. So then we skip ahead through the years of being a pediatrician and through the years of the career transition and midlife crisis, which we could talk about later. But I'm going to fast forward us to 2007.
Okay.
Because all through my life, I've always had little jokes and puns that pop into my head. And it actually, frankly, I think helped me in medical school because it helped me to memorize things because I would find little jokey wordplay things that would help me remember things. And most of these little puns and things I would keep to myself. Sometimes I would voice them if someone was nearby, and sometimes they would laugh. Of course, I loved the Far Side cartoons, and I loved his wordplay.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bizarro came along, which was a little more surreal, but also he clearly had a penchant for wordplay. So in 2007, I said to a colleague of mine, I've got this idea for a kind of New Yorker one-panel cartoon. And I told him the idea. He said, you know, that's funny. And I think it's the kind of thing that Dan Pararo would probably do in Bizarro. He has a blog and he has an open connection to his fans. You should send in that joke idea. So I figured I had nothing to lose. So I sent in the idea.
You figured you'd already called Charles M. Schulz. Why not contact Dan Pararo?
At that point, it was like 40 years earlier. So why not? Nothing to lose. So he wrote back and essentially his message was, I get a lot of joke ideas from people that I turn down. But in fact, this is my kind of humor. Can you verify that this is an original gag? And if so, I'd like to draw it. So obviously that was thrilling, and he did. And so that was my first one in late 2007. And then I had a few more ideas pop into my head. I sent those. He liked one or two of those. And then it turned out he was coming up to San Francisco to do a stand-up routine at a comedy club. So I arranged to meet him and we just really hit it off.
Was it a big joke fest? You guys are just kidding around the whole time?
Yeah, he just, you know, when you find someone who has your sense of humor, it's the best.
Pretty great.
And
yeah.
I also had as an ulterior motive a children's book manuscript that I needed an artist for. And as soon as he accepted the cartoon idea, my wife and I were thinking, oh, maybe this guy would illustrate the children's book. And the children's book was based on letter puzzles. So I brought along my manuscript of that when I met him. And he also loves brain teasers and puzzles, and he was into it. So we started a relationship where he and I worked together on that children's book manuscript. And I joined this small handful of gag writers for him. Most of the stuff he would write himself and draw, but it's a pretty tough order to come up with a joke every day.
Sure.
And he has been doing it for like 40 years, something.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot. You can't sort of force that creativity to just keep coming day after day.
So it was of real value to him to have a few jokes kind of in the drawer that he could just pull from.
Sure.
If he was having a dry spell.
Yeah.
So I now had a reason to write down every little funny gag or idea that came into my mind, or even to hang on to the ideas that I thought might be the germ of some kind of a cartoon gag. So it became a really fun thing with my family in 2007, 2008. Ooh. My kids were 5 and 8. And so around the kitchen table, somebody would say something and I would just go, okay, wait, There's a Bizarro in there. Let's keep working on this. What do we, how do we massage this into a Bizarro? And both of my boys had a couple of their jokes that came to them that became Bizarro.
Made it in. Oh, that must have felt great.
That was so sweet. So over the years, I think I've had about 120 that he accepted. And probably my hit rate is about 25%, maybe. So I would typically send him, yeah, four or five ideas, and he might take one. And it's been fascinating in retrospect, because I realize now that there were a couple of years, I'd say 2012, 13, 14, when I was particularly prolific with the joke ideas, always sending things to him. And I think I had about 25 per year accepted in that time frame. And those were probably some of the most miserable years of my life. We had just all kinds of very stressful things happening in the family, with deaths and illnesses, and between my family and my wife's family. I'm the only one with a medical background, so I was always called in to, you know, liaison with the doctors and help make tough decisions. And
yeah.
So the years after that, I'd say 2017, 18, 19, and on, have been much better for my own mental health, and a lot slower for the joke idea spontaneity. Mm-hmm. Not so much, I mean, I think in conversation or at work or whatever, I feel the same, but I feel like maybe I was purposely looking for opportunities to get a joke crafted, perfected, submitted, accepted, published, because it was always such a thrill. And I needed that as that little icing, that little thrill. Maybe that's what it's about. I mean, also, when you look at interviews or memoirs with comedians, a lot of the time they tend to be pretty troubled people.
That's right.
And Charles Schulz himself was lifelong depressed and had a very challenging childhood. You know, he was small for his age and he was super bright, and his parents put him forward two grades. So he was always tiny, and he really was Charlie Brown.
I was going to say. I thought he was the model for Charlie Brown, the pathetic little kid.
Yeah. You know, and there was a real little red-haired girl. So I guess what I can say is that because I've been happier, I've been less prolific as a joke writer. But every so often now, I don't feel the urge to keep them coming. It's really just an Easter egg when I find one in my brain, or somebody says something and I'll think, oh, wait a minute. If you twist that, or you make a spoonerism out of it, or you know, whatever, that could be a Bizarro.
I was thinking, when you're talking about the harder years, almost your brain looking for some light or some levity or some joy in those dark times. It's interesting how the mind could have worked.
The pattern is undeniable as I look back on it. There is a sort of fascinating linking chapter to the Charles Schulz story, which is that about 6 or 7 years ago, I was reading a book about the life of Charles M. Schulz, who was known as Sparky to his friends. That's what everybody called him. So the book's called Sparky. It was written after he died, and it was written based on interviews with his widow, Jeannie Schulz, and his children. And one of the things that the author writes is how Sparky was always keen to mentor young cartoonists and would always go out of his way to help them, spend time with them, and that this was something very meaningful to him. So I'm sitting on the couch reading the book. My older son is sitting next to me, and I read this line in the book that says, "In fact, Sparky even answered the phone one day to find an 8-year-old budding cartoonist eager to interview him."
Ah, Clef.
And I'm getting goosebumps now again as I tell the story. And of course, at the moment that I read that, I thought, that's got to be me. That was me. Wait, what?
He remembered me.
Yeah. So one of the cartoonists who he had mentored was Dan Peraro.
Is that right?
So I contacted Dan, told him this whole story, and I said, is there a way you could get a message to Jeannie Schultz? So he said, yeah. He said, write all this stuff down and I'll forward the email to her. And then she can write back to you if she wants to. So I did. And I told her, okay, this, it would have been fall of 1971, and tried to give her more of the particulars. And she wrote back and said, yes, that all adds up. That must have been you. And so here's the other part of it. I would have thought that this happened every day to him. Like, why did this stand out? I don't think there was anything particular about me or the questions I asked him or anything. When I was 8, maybe I still had a British accent. I don't know. It was probably gone by that point. But clearly, he didn't get these calls every day. Mm-hmm. And my mother, she had a lot of chutzpah. And she didn't hesitate, obviously, to advocate for her son or to call someone she didn't know, even if they were famous. And so having his phone number be listed was, I guess, not a nuisance for him, at least in 1971, because he didn't have the number unlisted yet. And he must not have gotten calls from a lot of kids because he remembered the call. And he must have not only remembered it, but remembered it and retold the story to his children or his wife, because they're the ones who were interviewed for the book.
So it was a few degrees of separation.
Yeah, it must have been.
That's how it impacted.
I don't know, kind of a little story. Like, I remember when that kid called me, or I don't know. So it actually all links back also, Elizabeth, to my work now in medical philanthropy and fundraising. Because one of the things I've come to learn, and I talk about this a lot in the consulting work I do, which is mainly focused on helping doctors understand that if someone expresses interest in supporting their work, it's a service to that person to facilitate their support, that it's not something manipulative or coercive, and that people who give find meaning in their giving and joy in their giving. And so if they say they want to give, help them do that. You're doing it for them. You're not doing it to them. So for me to ask, can I have some of your time and ask you these questions? And for him to choose to give me his time, it must have been something that had meaning for him and that he enjoyed doing. And so it stays for me as a great reminder of why we shouldn't hesitate to ask. Because sometimes if the person has what we need and it's meaningful to them to be able to give, they'll always remember it and it'll be meaningful to them.
I think that's something that we understand more as we get older too. I think as younger people, we think, oh, we're just taking from them, or why would they want to share? But as you get older, you realize you have knowledge, experience, and you want to share what you have. The desire to be a mentor or to give some of your life experience, your money, your wisdom, whatever it might be, we want to pass that on. And you don't understand that as much as a young person.
Yeah.
That is just a beautiful story. It actually brought tears to my eyes. The thought of him remembering you, I think a little more credit is due to you as a young kid. You probably asked some pretty impactful questions. That conversation was not just two questions. You probably really thought through things that you wanted to ask him about. You were clearly interested in the topic and interested in him. So it was a meaningful experience both ways.
Both ways. Yeah. That was a rare, remarkable moment of all these things converging in my life.
I wanted to read you a quote from Dan Peraro. I don't know if you've heard this one before, but he wrote this about you. It was actually about a strip that the two of you made together. You wrote and he illustrated. This idea came from my good friend, Cliff Harris, who is a wordsmith extraordinaire. He plays with words in unusual ways, writes word puzzles, writes stories in puzzle form, and just generally defies the laws of language in ways that make me wonder if he was dropped on his head as a baby. Funny guy.
Yeah.
I am just wondering where the ideas come from for you. You mentioned that sometimes they're just pop into your head, but do you sometimes...
Here's something I thought we might do. If I can share my screen...
Yeah.
I know it's a podcast, but you and I can be looking at a cartoon and I can tell you about where the ideas came from for these. So here's someone.
I'll just read this. There's a gentleman filling out a form and another. The first guy says, name, Cliff Harris. Address? No, a suit.
So where did this come from? This just came from somebody said that to me, like address. And I just heard it as this, as like, a dress? So here's another part of perhaps where these come from. I have a genetic hearing loss and I wear hearing aids. Sometimes I mishear things and I'll mishear them in a funny way.
Mm.
There's a cartoon. One man is shoving a box of the cereal Grape Nuts at the chest of a second man.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, some are born to Grape Nuts. Some achieve Grape Nuts, and some have Grape Nuts thrust upon them. This came from, there was an interview with a football captain and trying to inspire the team, and he said, you've got to be pissed off for greatness. And I heard Grape Nuts, and I thought, pissed off for Grape Nuts? I mean, I kind of knew what he had said, but at the same time, I heard that. And so then I'm left with greatness and Grape Nuts. And of course, where does my mind go except the Shakespeare quote?
Right.
Have Grape Nuts thrust upon them.
Oh, it's so good. Do you want to describe this one?
This is a little boy and a very old man sitting on a couch watching TV. And there's a commercial on TV. It says, fun for ages 4 to 104. And both the little boy and the old man think to themselves, dang. So clearly the boy must be 3 and the man must be 105. So this is just one of these things that, you know, you've heard that all your life, you know,
yep.
Fun wages 8 to 80.
Yeah.
It occurred to me, well, who are you excluding here?
Yeah.
And this is a great example of, after we published this, Dan and I were talking about it and we realized there was an opportunity missed. There's often an opportunity missed after it's published, but here it would have been, see, there's a little dog sleeping next to the old man, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if the commercial said, fun for people ages 4 to 104, then all three of them could be thinking, dang.
Oh, right. That is funny.
Here's an example of one that was my younger son's idea. It's a Christmas morning, and a maybe 10-year-old boy opens a box, which appears to be empty. And he says, oh boy, a new air guitar. And his little brother says, can I have your old one? And this was just something that my younger son said. He was opening a box and he goes, oh, it's an air guitar.
He's got your sense of humor.
He does. So here's one. Here's an operating theater and the doctor says, I shall now amputate the patient's legs with my bare hands. And the nurse thinks, I don't think he can pull it off. So this is the kind of thing that I love the most. When there's a common phrase, and I'll think about applying the common phrase in an unusual situation that would make it funny.
Yes.
You can take, I don't think you can pull it off. What must have happened in this case is I heard somebody say that. And then I thought, well, pull it off. Maybe what if, yeah. So you get.
It's almost like when you hear someone learning English as a second language and they'll say, what do you mean by that? You know,
yes.
What do you mean you can pull that off? And we said, well, so we don't really mean actually pull it off. It's not a literal phrase. So you're using it both ways, the sort of idiom and then literally.
This is a great point. And this may be part of why my brain works this way. When I was in pediatric practice, my niche in the community was Spanish-speaking families. I had worked and studied some in Mexico and Central America. And 31 years ago, met my wife, who is from rural Mexico herself and came here at age 8. And so I've been living around Spanish speakers for a long time. And often I will say to my wife, you know, this idiom in Spanish, or when you say this and this, doesn't it sound like why do you say it that way? And then she'll go, you know, I never thought of it that way. Or she will come to me and she'll question an idiom and say, that sounds so weird that you say it that way. And then I'll think, oh, I never thought of it.
Yeah.
Here's a Peanuts themed one. As a patient in a psychiatrist's office, and the patient says, my sister treats me like Lucy treats Linus. And the psychiatrist says, sounds like you've got an allergy to Peanuts.
This one, so I was rolling on the floor.
This is where I just heard the word analogy and thought to myself, well, if you're like from New York, analogy, I've got an allergy. So then often the pun comes first, and then the question is, how do you build on it and make a scene out of it where it makes sense within the universe of that little world? So that's something that Dan Peraro always pushes for, is that it has to be a coherent little universe where there's some reason why this is happening and it makes sense in itself.
And you brought in your Peanuts connection, your Charles M. Schulz.
Yeah. Okay, here's a patient who, of course, is wearing a gown which is open at the backside, and his doctor is wearing a white coat that's open at the backside. He's got his coat turned backwards, too. And so the patient says, thanks, doctor. I feel like you really understand me. So what happened with this is, of course, it occurred to me when I was in the doctor's office. When this was published, someone wrote and complained that they had published a cartoon with this idea. And they sent it to Dan. And it was basically this premise, a little different scenario, but the same concept of, wouldn't it be funny if a doctor wore their white coat backward the way we wear the patient gowns backwards? And it was published in a small newsletter for some organization, and it never went beyond that. So there really was no way that we would have seen it. But what it shows you is that with 8 billion people in the world, someone's going to think of your joke.
Yes.
I would say easily for every one joke idea that I send in, I probably actually have two joke ideas, but I have to Google them first and look for them in Google Images to see if a cartoon's been done. And some of the most frustrating ones are when you realize that someone did do it before. Like, I'll get some pun idea. Like, okay, I was thinking of Easter Island, and instead of the heads poking up, what if they were butts and it was Keister Island? All right, it's silly. Little thing. But, you know, the word keister is funny.
Yeah, it's a funny word.
And it'll make it through the censors because it's keister and it's probably going to be just fine. But someone had already done it. And what Dan said is, you know, 20 years ago, you never had to worry about that. Because unless it had appeared in the Sunday funnies, in the newspaper, how were you supposed to have read every book that's out there or seen? You weren't. But now that you can know or do your research, you're expected to do your research, which is a bummer.
So when something comes to you like that, like, oh, Easter, Keister, huh? Do you just have a little notebook that you carry around with you and keep notes of your ideas?
Yeah, I usually email them to myself. I don't do it now because, as I said, it's not as active. But in my really active years, I kept a running list and I would wait till I had 5 or 6 of them, and I would test them out with friends. In fact, I have a friend who, you see, once you begin an opportunity like this to be a joke writer for a comic strip, then your friends start sending their joke ideas to you.
They want to be in on it.
Yeah. And so I get these from a variety of friends. There's one friend, my best friend in particular, he's a pretty funny guy, and I like some of his ideas. So sometimes I have taken his ideas and sent them on to Dan saying, this is from my friend Jerry. And I've even said, could you put his name in the signature line instead of mine? But that was a reach too far. So he put it in with my name. And so what Jerry and I will do is we will text each other joke ideas. And then the format is the response to the text is a number between 1 and 10. And if it's above 7.0, that means send it in. If it's less than 7.0, it means don't send it in. It's not good enough.
It's a little rating system.
Often I'll send him an idea and he'll write, he'll text back 6.9998, which is his way of saying, I love you, Clifford. This is cute, but don't send it in.
keep working on this idea.
Yeah. So those letter puzzles, that came from, do you know William Steig's book, CDB?
Yes.
So I loved that book when I was a kid, as we all did. And I guess I got reacquainted with it after I had children. And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be cool to write a whole book with a plot that uses these letter puzzles for the dialogue? Like if you had a sort of a graphic novel. At that point, I was living in the Oakland area. I was working at Oakland Children's. And then I started working for Stanford and I was commuting. So I had this long commute on a bus every day. And I would sit there and I made this grid of all the letters in the alphabet and combined them to see what might sound like words. So it was AA, AB, AC, AD, AD. Oh, that sounds like 80, AD, AE. And so I came up with this list of maybe 200 fairly complex, sometimes polysyllabic words that I could say in that format where you say the name of the letter. And then, of course, you add numbers into the mix and you have more variety. So I had this whole vocabulary.
It's like looking at vanity license plates.
Exactly.
Like my nephew's name is Nate. And I often thought if you just put an N and the number yes. 8, that's Nate.
Exactly.
So it's that sort of thing.
So first, I had this idea for a fairly simple book, a children's book, and that didn't end up going anywhere. But then with Dan's partnership, it turned into more of a book that was like a graphic novel, not specifically geared to children. And so we could be a lot broader with the themes. So I came up with a script for this graphic novel, all in letter puzzle format. And Dan loved it. And he drew up some pages. His agent loved it. And we thought we were off to the races, but we had this fascinating experience of the publishing companies that the agent sent the manuscript and the sample pages to. There would usually be one or two people at that publishing house that would say, oh, this is brilliant. I love it. It's so much fun. And then there would be two or three people who say, oh my God, this gives me a headache. Are you kidding? A whole book like this?
Oh.
And it seemed like it was very polarizing. They thought it was great, or it just gave them a headache and they couldn't understand why people liked it.
Because they were frustrated.
They were frustrated.
Their mind doesn't think that way.
And I came to realize that it's almost like some kind of a, maybe a personality test. Because it's not intelligence. It's just, does your brain work in a way where you can comfortably look at the letters and read them as their letter names without reading them as a word? And then sound it out and listen to what you're saying so that if you have X and then the number 10 and then the letter U and then the number 8, can you say that's, oh, that's extenuate or
extenuate,
you
know. Yeah. And
we also, Dan and I published a few of these in Bizarro. We would usually do them in a Sunday panel because he had more space. We saw the same thing in the comments on the blog. There would be, I'm going to say, half the people who would say, please do more of these. It's so much fun. My family and I sat down, had a great time figuring these out. And there would be other people who would say, never do this again. Are you crazy? This is painful. I hate this.
I find it very satisfying. I think it's fun. It's like it's a little challenging. And you feel like you've conquered something. Like, I did it. I figured that out.
Well, there you go. You're my kind of person. So suffice it to say, that book never got published.
Too polarizing.
Yeah. This is a recent one. The way he drew this panel, the, I don't know, man or woman who's really irritating the other client just looks so annoying as she says, can you decipher this one,
Elizabeth? Let's see. Esat? No.
Yes.
Esat? KQR?
Uh-huh.
Eaton? Oh, is that KQR? KQR Eaton? Is that KQR Eaton?
Uh-huh.
Is that KQR eating?
Uh-huh. Is that KQR eating?
And he's clearly, it is. He is eating chocolate
cake. It is cake he's eating. Yes,
yes. Yes.
If I ever get a tattoo, which I don't think I will, but if I ever do, I think I am going to get the number 8 the at symbol and the number two, so it reads a tattoo.
You have to stay true to your craft.
That's right.
I'm wondering, is there some intersection among all of your different strains of work, you know, doing that and your consultant work for medical fundraising and what you used to do as a physician? How do you see them all align? Or are they different parts of your personality, different parts of your brain?
So maybe in a different hour or in some other venue, I'll talk to you more in depth about how I came to leave the practice of medicine. But suffice it to say, it became too stressful, basically. Mm-hmm. I loved it. And then once I had my own kids, the experience of taking care of other people's sick children became too stressful. In the process, when I started realizing how it was affecting me, the increased stress, and I toyed with the idea of maybe I'm going to find a different niche in medicine that's not on the front lines. One of my partners in the practice said to me, you know, it's okay if you quit. I've seen how miserable you've become in the past year. And that was such a light bulb moment for me. And I came home and said to my wife, would you be okay if I'm not a doctor anymore? And she's like, I just want you to be the happy guy that I married. Do whatever you need to do. So that night I had this dream. I'm at this like a dungeon long table in a medieval castle. And there's all these Vikings with fur vests and horned helmets. And I'm at the head of the table. And all the Vikings have these goblets of red wine. And they all have their arms around each other. And they're carousing. And they're toasting me at the head of the table. And they're chanting, he's leaving medicine. He's leaving.
Wow, this is so vivid.
And I literally sat up in a sweat, just like in the movies, so yeah. Panting from a dream. And I just said to the voices of those men around the table, I said, okay, I hear you. I promise I'm going to do it. I didn't know what the next step was going to be. I just knew that I had to do this. I had to honor what my body was telling me mm-hmm. and now what my psyche was telling me. And it was a mourning period, hanging up the stethoscope and that image of myself as a pediatrician, which I had had since I was a teenager. And so it was a lot of stuff going on. And so I said to a friend of mine, I don't think I need to pay $250 to have a psychiatrist help me interpret this dream. I think this is pretty clear. And my friend said, yeah, but who were the people around the table?
Oh, the nuance.
Yeah. So I said, okay, I guess I do need to go to a therapist to figure that out. What I came to realize is that those were the parts of me that had been submerged and suppressed and tucked into a corner, perhaps because of the intensity of my chosen profession at that point.
Wow, that's huge.
It certainly was all consuming, and I loved it. But free time, I was reading medical journals, and I had other things too, and music and stuff. And it was extremely satisfying, but it was also
consuming.
Huge. It was a huge consuming. Yeah. And so there was parts of me, I guess the part that wanted to be more goofy. Mm-hmm. So I can say that I don't think this would have emerged in the same way during the years I was practicing medicine, maybe because I wouldn't have just had the space in my head to really relish and dive into and seek opportunities for play like this, wordplay, jokes.
And that makes sense too. And also why those guys with the steins and the furry coats come out, because when you're so devoted to something, you have to sometimes close other things out, especially a really intense career. You devote so much time, study, years. That's your identity for so long.
Yeah.
You put that cloak on and you just have to focus. And so I think your analysis, it all makes sense. You have to sort of untangle
yourself. I think that
yourself.
Other people can accomplish it. Maybe it's something about my personality or an intensity or something. For me, it was all consuming. Yeah.
And I think also some people can compartmentalize things more than others. Some people can juggle a lot more. Like, I can't juggle a lot of things. I can multitask. But when I devote myself to something, I like to really devote myself to it. Different personality types can handle different things at different times. And as long as you know yourself really well, it's great that you had that reflective time and took a big step. Sounds like that's what you needed at that time.
That may be part of why that separation between treating ill or critically ill children and having my own babies at home, I wasn't able to compartmentalize that. And that's part of why it all spilled over and it just became untenable. So thank goodness for Bizarro.
Yeah. Well, I think when you're a creative person, can't really stifle it forever. It's got to have an outlet.
Yeah. I can't talk about Bizarro on your podcast without giving a little plug to what Dan Peraro is doing now. He's working on a graphic novel, which is fascinating and beautiful, and he's publishing it serially. He's taking so much time on the artwork that he publishes maybe one chapter every, and a chapter is maybe 10 or 12 images. That's it. But maybe one a month. But the artwork is just next level. It's just beautiful. And the story is crazy, wacky. And I mean, like, it's a sort of a Twilight Zone, kind of a Western theme. So it's called Peyote Cowboy. Highly recommended. He's a phenomenal talent.
And you'll just keep working with him as long as you want to?
Yeah, I think maybe this year I've had two or three, and that's fine. As I said, I don't feel compelled. I really used to, in those very productive years, if I had some downtime, I would like actively try to think of cartoon ideas. And now I don't feel that urgency about it.
I think these things come when they come. That's the creative spirit.
The muse.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Cliff. It's just been so fascinating. I love all of these stories. It's been a joy for me. So thank you for taking the time.
Thanks so much for being interested and for asking.
I was so moved by Cliff's stories and reflections, and by his ability to find through lines among the many chapters of his life. Here are some of my takeaways from our conversation. Number one, take initiative. Make the phone call, reach out to someone, take a risk. You never know what might happen. Two, if someone reaches out to you for assistance or advice, consider being that patient, generous, humble mentor Charles M. Schulz was to Cliff. 3. Remember that people who give find meaning and joy in their giving. We shouldn't hesitate to ask. 4. Honor what your body is telling you, what your psyche is telling you, and what your dreams are telling you, especially if they include big Viking men chanting at you with furry vests and goblets. 5. Make some space to evaluate where you are and what you need. Take a big step if it's time to make a change. And finally, number 6, dive into, seek, and relish opportunities for play. Be goofy. I can't thank Cliff Harris enough for joining me. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the cartoons that Cliff and I talked and laughed about during the interview are linked at the show notes on our website, whatitsliketo.net. We've also posted the link to Dan Peraro's new book, Peyote Cowboy, there. Please follow us on social media and tell a few friends about our podcast, too. And if you'd like to contribute to this podcast, please click on the button Support the Show at the bottom of the show notes page. I'm Elizabeth Pearson Garr. Thanks for being curious about what it's like.